Victor.
Is there such a thing as there's free will? Is there free? People talk about free will. Because thoughts come and go, right? So, what determines how these thoughts come and go? Do they? Are we doing something to make them appear, or is it just cause and effect? Is there some way? I'm confused about the whole thing.
You are free to make your own decisions as long as you take responsibility for them. Don't worry about the coming and going, mm-hmm. because in this moment you have to decide something. Every moment you have to decide something, and you're free to decide whatever your wisdom tells you.
So when the thought comes in and we grab onto it, that's a decision we made, rather than letting it go through.
Well, rather than grab it, just let it come and take a seat in front of you gently and absorb it and understand it and let it inform you. Let it inform you. Your thought is trying to tell you something. So be gentle with it and reflect on it. Treat it as a friend. And then you decide what to do. Maybe you'll decide to ignore it. That's a decision. You may decide you have to do something. So you should go ahead and do it.
But, in meditation, though, we're not supposed to do that in meditation, right? You're talking about outside of meditation, when thoughts come.
Well, isn't that what you're asking about?
Both, really.
No, you've got me confused.
Oh, okay. So meditation, when you're meditating, that's different than everyday life. When you're outside of meditation, you kind of look at your thoughts.
It's too much.
Too much?
Too much. Let's agree to end there. Thank you. Oh, Joe.
Thank you. A friend of mine asked me just today if it was compatible with Buddhist philosophy to euthanize a dog or to remove someone from life support. I answered as best as I could, but I have to confess that I had never thought about it.
What was the first part? I didn't quite get on.
Euthanize a suffering animal. A dying animal.
Yes.
If it was compatible with Buddhist philosophy to euthanize it.
So, Buddhist teaching is all about the relief of suffering. And it's also about no taking life. So what will you do in that moment when you have to make a choice? Each of us has to make that choice almost every moment, it seems. If we say, this is Buddhist philosophy, then we have an answer that we can carry around for the rest of our lives and we never make a decision about it. We have to bring our heart and mind to the situation in the moment and determine what's the compassionate thing to do. Don't take life. Put an end to suffering. How do you decide that one? Your friend had a good question. So if you see him again and he asks it again, what will you tell him?
She was asking me this question in response to a Buddhist teacher or a Buddhist student that she knew who had said that you had no right to intervene in someone else's destiny, someone else's karmic path. What I said was that you had no right to make a choice for someone else, and therefore doing that for someone who had requested it seemed all right to me. Doing that, taking it on yourself to do that to someone who hadn't requested it, such as an animal, wouldn't be all right. And that you had to ask yourself, when you were faced with that conundrum, whether your concern was to remove the suffering of the animal or to remove your own suffering and watching again. And that if your motivation was to remove your own suffering, then it was not really the right thing to do. Based on what you have said, that reminded me of something that I heard early when I started this practice, which is that pain is pain, but suffering is optional. And I think that reinforces what I felt before, that ending pain and ending
I think the choice we make in that moment when we have to make a decision, that choice must come from the heart and not from the head. Bonnie.
So I'm thinking a lot about this actually, and I feel like there's something Brenda would say if she was here, but she's not here. So I know there's situations where you might not have this as an option, but I'd say the first thing I would do is look for a third option. And so a third option might be to give the dog an anesthetic, to to relieve the pain, but you're not taking its life. You're making it an easier transition for the dog, you know, to comfort the dog, to make the dog as comforted as possible. Because Brenda's an anesthesiologist, so that's how she kind of reduces pain. But I also see that sometimes you might not have that as an option. You're in the wilderness or something, and then you can't do that. But it's just what occurred to me that sometimes looking, when faced with a really hard ultimatum, sometimes we have to look, is there some option I haven't even considered?
Thank you. Umar.
I've brought up this subject before. My father was incapacitated for 25 years of his life. We had to feed him and take him to the bathroom, and sometimes we'd give him 100 milligrams of Valium at night and he was still in good sleep. One day I was talking to my cousin and she just turned around and looked at me and said, why don't you just give him poison and kill him? I was kind of very confused by this. The whole idea was that she had all of her life, she had lived in this country, in this culture, and she came here over there, and it was very hard for her to understand him or communicate with him. But, you know, it's like everything that is, anything that is difficult or anything that's painful, we have a tendency of looking away or shying away from that. And in that context, it's like, oh, the dog is in pain. I remember I had a dog and he had developed a wound on the back. And every night I would clean up his wound and take out all the maggots from his wound and with a tweezer and clean it out and sort of patch it back up. And the second day he would have, because he would get itchy and he would pull it out. So, but doing that every night, after like 3 weeks, his wound started to heal. And we got him a collar so that, you know, he couldn't scratch himself. And so I was like, this is interesting that, you know, it wasn't, for me, it's never been a straight path to shy away from pain and suffering. It's like pain is there, problems are there, but you can't really, there is no other option but to face it. You have to face it. For me, it's never been, from the very beginning, it's just been like, I had to face it. I mean, it's like, I would have never even thought about it. Like somebody saying to me, why don't you kill your dog or kill your dad? For that reason, I was like, oh, this is really interesting. And along those lines, one of the things that I've come to realize is that people who live in cultures or communities that have everything available to them seem to be in more suffering than the people who don't have anything. People are happier. And they care about each other. It's absolutely, just sometimes boggles my mind. I'm going, this is interesting that this happens. And how does this happen? Why have we lost that capacity? And I was in Hawaii, it was raining. First day of London. And I still remember the kids were jumping in the puddles that the rain was making. And it was so amazing to see the kids jumping in the puddle. It was just like, they were happy. There was just joy in them. And mom and dad were running to get into the car, and the kids didn't care if mom and dad were running to get into the car. They were enjoying it. And I looked at the mom and said, what happens to us? Why do we lose this enjoyment of the simplest things in life? Kids don't have very much. They enjoy everything. We as adults grow up, we have everything in life, and we develop all these sufferings. All the enjoyment goes out of us, all the happiness goes out of us, and we are, you know, it's like we become like this sort of animal that's sort of fighting its own reflection or its own shadow. And I don't understand this sometimes.
Perhaps you do, but don't yet realize it. Yes, please.
Actually, very enjoy. I remember a story, a movie that my daughter showed.
Is it a question?
No, I was just following. So there's this movie called Forrest Gump. She showed me, and in that, he is taken in the military and sent to Vietnam, and in there he has a friend. And the friend says, one day I want to do a shrimp business with you. They're just talking and always saying that. So the war breaks out and they have a captain in the military, the group that they have. And the war breaks out and people are dying now, right? And this person, he's running and he's the only one who is able to escape the damage. But he's going in again, bringing each and every person and putting them. They're telling him, let me die. I don't want to live like that because, of course, all the damages have happened, right? They don't want to live like that. So the captain has got hurt all over and he says, let me die. Don't carry me, don't save my life. So he decides, says, right now I feel I should carry you and I should take you in a safe place. So he carries him, takes him to the safe place. So he does that to many, like four or five people, whomever he could carry, and even the friend who wanted to do shrimp business, he carries him also and puts it in the same kind of row. And the person, the shrimp business friend, dies after doing this, the decision of him bringing and putting them. And the captain, who is hurt very badly, survives, and they are all in the they are shown in the rehab center. Somebody has lost their hand, some all kind of injuries, and the captain kind of abuses him over there because he has lost both his legs and feels that he has no life. And why am I living like that? It's because of you. I have to live. You made that decision to save me when I could have died and not have to live like that. So basically, it's that moment's decision. This person felt right to just bring them to a safe place and keep. And eventually, he goes and starts a shrimp business, this person, because he wants to remember for his friend. And the captain, he includes the captain, and the captain is now holding that business for him because he doesn't want to. He doesn't know anything about it. And the captain is now living on the boat or on that ship, wherever, and holding the business, and then thanks him for saving his life. So I just remembered that story, that he could have left. There were two choices. He could have listened to them, left them to die, or do what he felt right, carry them and put them to a safe place. As much as one died and one survived, the surviving one kind of blamed him for saving his life, and without two legs he had to live, but eventually he thanks him. So I think at that moment it is a very difficult decision what life has to offer. So how do you know that that is the right decision for someone else? like if the person...
You don't know.
You don't know. How?
You make a decision based on your compassion and your wisdom and all of your faculties come together and you make a decision. But in the moment you make the decision, if you step back and say, oh, maybe this is the wrong decision. That's where the confusion comes. You make a decision, and someday somebody may say to you, that was the wrong decision. But at the time, you acted from your heart, and that's all you could do. So you have to have confidence in yourself. When these difficult moments arise. Thank you. Dave.
Unless what you just said about having confidence in yourself, and in particular, confidence in your compassion, reminds me of a discussion I had he hasn't been around here lately, but there was a fellow who was coming here on and off for quite a while, who was doing wonderful work with disadvantaged children. And he said one time he kind of distrusted his own motivations for doing this. He wondered if maybe he was doing it for selfish reasons. And as we talked about it, it seemed to me that there's a sort of flip side to this thing of doing something that's really in your own interest and telling yourself that you're being compassionate to somebody else. And that is, when you really do feel true compassion for someone else, you have to trust that. And he was second-guessing his own compassionate feeling. He couldn't really have faith in the compassion that he was feeling and actually expressing and acting on, but he had these doubts about it. And I thought that was really too bad and something that we really all have to watch out for.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else have a question? Oh, yes, Jaya?
So we're talking about decisions, and so is it possible that we can just frame it? To me, it's like a framing issue. Because when we make it, we're in a moment, and we have to do what's right from our wisdom, from heart, from compassion. And the minute we say we're deciding, then it's like you're deciding. It's you. It's your ego. It's what you want to do. As opposed to you're serving the moment. So moment to moment, perhaps if we just think about it as serving, then it takes it away from you and your motivations and your own desires, and perhaps puts it in a way that is more thinking about the other person or what is needed for that situation. So I don't know what you think about the idea of serving the moment.
Serving the moment. I don't know what that means.
So the way I think about it is, So you're really doing what's right for, not just what's for you, because oftentimes when we have to decide, then our own motivations and what's best for us always seems to drive us. So the example that Dave gave about when you're doing some community service, it's always, well, it makes me feel good. But if you think about it as what's right, not just for me, but for the entire situation. Not only is it good for me, but it's also good for this particular cause, let's say. So I just sometimes feel like it's a framing issue. And when we go, when we think about that we're deciding, I'm the one, then it becomes so much about you and less about the moment. It's just a, something that I've been grappling with.
It's like being on the battlefield, like you say. It's very dangerous. It's very uncertain. But when you hear a cry for help, or feel, when you feel a cry for help, you give it your best effort. On the battlefield, you don't have time to frame it. If you see a toddler fall into the water, you jump right in. And that's all you need to know. Thank you. We have time. We have time for more questions. If you have some. Yes, please.
So, is the moment only about time, or is there other dimensions to it, like maybe space, or people, or things?
in the moment,
yeah.
There's no time or space. Yes, Richard.
These sort of questions about what's the right thing to do in the moment, it's like a dynamic situation with a person or an animal. I think a part of it has to do with the fear of being criticized, like, and second guessed. Well, why did you do that? And we have to kind of come up with an explanation or an argument. And if we're acting from our heart, then we're making a subjective judgment. So two people could make the opposite choice and both be right, I guess. I wonder if there is an objective perspective or objective reality to it, or are we living with our own judgment as best we can? I had a friend who had a German Shepherd a few years ago that was having a lot of trouble. He was older, and, you know, and she was really confused on what to do, and she's getting different advice from different friends, and I didn't give her any advice, you know. I just stayed with the dog, and eventually she did have somebody come over and euthanize him, and I thought that was compassionate to let him go, but that was her decision, not mine. So I'm not gonna judge that. What is your view about objective versus subjective experience? We have to make in any given moment. Is there such a thing as an objective reality in that?
In objective.
No pressure.
Try to understand the terminology. Objective reality.
Well, similar to our political situation, everyone has alternative facts. Is there like some reality that we can all agree upon, or do we have to appeal to the authority of a doctor or a philosopher? Or can we? You know, does the objective reality of the world exist, or is it just an illusion that we hold on to?
When people disagree, it's because they hold different sets of values, different sets of what they feel are right and wrong, or what they feel is most helpful. If we cannot agree on a common set of values, we will always be at war with each other. And what seems to be happening in the modern world compared to the less modern world, what Umar was talking about, we are becoming further and further apart from each other because of values. The values Umar was referring to in a less sophisticated society, he felt was happier. And in the modern world, we seem to have values that cause us to conflict with each other. So the only objective reality is the exploration that each of us does to find what are the most helpful values, the values that will bring peace, stability, and all those things. So part of our practice is actually each of us is making an exploration of our own value system. What do I really believe in? What is really the best way to live for the benefit of everybody and not just me personally? So, despite what goes on in politics, each of us should make the effort to say, what really are the values that I find most important and that should guide me in my life? While everybody else is debating, each of us should make that effort, make that journey. You know, put aside the newspaper, turn off the news, just say, what's the real deal here? What do I believe in? I think that's the objective reality. Thank you. Yes, please.
Yes. It seems like a major source of anxiety and suffering in people's lives is feeling like they have to make a decision in the moment that has to be perfect in the future.
Mm.
And that's not possible. If you have, it would seem to me that if you have confidence, fearlessness in your compassion, you make a decision in the moment, and the outcome is what it is. So when the outcome happens, if there's a problem with the outcome, you deal with that problem in that moment, but not before.
It's good. Thank you. Dave.
So there's something that's been sort of weaving through this conversation that is maybe obvious, but I think it's worth kind of underlining, and that is that when we're facing these conundrums, you know, am I being selfish? Am I being compassionate? What's the right thing to do? That the thing in our lives that shines a light on that and helps us really understand what to do is our practice. And outside of our practice, we can't address these problems just by thinking about them in the conventional sense of thinking. I remember I went to a very interesting talk a few years ago by a woman who had been on a long-term visit to a Buddhist monastery in Thailand when the Banda Aceh tsunami struck. And there was all that suffering and death, disease, and she immediately went there. And she had training and background so she could actually help. And she was there in the middle of this terrible, terrible tragedy. She intentionally went there and she helped. And she told us about it. And she said, you know, after a while I stopped trying to explain what I did to non-Buddhists because they would always ask me questions like, wasn't that horrible for you to go there and be with all of that suffering? Didn't it make you feel good about yourself to have done this? It was always about small self, small self. It was never about manifesting the compassion that comes from your practice. And I thought that was a very interesting thing, given that she'd been through this incredible experience.
Did she say anything about how Buddhists related to her after she came back?
The Buddhists at the Insight Center in Redwood City that she gave this talk, and the entire audience seemed to understand exactly where she was coming from. And I got the impression that that was very much the kind of reaction that she got when she spoke to Buddhists about it, and that it wasn't that she was angry or dismissive or condescending to these other people, it was just that she found it essentially impossible to explain to them what she had done and why she did it. because they were also so horrified by the whole thing and thinking that, you know, she did it because it would make her feel better about herself.
Thank you. Well, let's see if we have somebody else. Megan.
I've been reading this book about Buddha. And in the book it says that meditation was a practice before Buddha ever lived, and that asceticism, people meditated. And that what Buddha did is you had to change your way of viewing the world or seeing through meditation. But meditation already existed, and sometimes I think there's too much of a focus on meditation, and I don't know, the koans, I guess, whatever, tries to change your mind. So it's not just meditation that we're doing, is my impression.
That's right. It's our view of the world and the attitude we bring to our life. Meditation without that is simply a technique that really doesn't last. But if you bring a determined attitude with it, along with it, and you make a vow, to follow the practice, and you make a vow not to be overwhelmed by, you know, desires. If you carry that vow, then the meditation has life, because it is accompanied by commitment. But without that, the meditation is just something you do on a casual basis. In the Zen mind, beginner's mind, Suzuki Roshi had a lecture. He said, don't let your zazen be like, you know, snacks in the refrigerator. You get hungry, well, you take a snack, and you put it back. And maybe later you get hungry again. But you have a snack, you put it back, and you forget about it. He says, don't forget about it. Don't treat it like that. So you're exactly right. Thank you. Yes, please.
I was struck by what you were saying about values and in communication with other people that you disagree. And what I've been practicing in my practice is listening and trying to understand the values of the other person. And once I connect with their values and understand why a person believes or is acting in a particular way, and what the value is that they have, then I can bring my values to it and we can reach a compromise or an understanding with one another. How does that interface with this?
Yes. It's listening, along with observing, is the start of what in this practice is called skillful means. Understanding a situation and what drives it or what motivates it, and trying to find a way to move it in a positive direction without upsetting anybody. To find a way to move in a creative direction that everybody can agree to. Thank you. Yes.
So I'm just wondering, what if you find yourself in a position where you find one person who has this value, that's raised from a different cultural background, and you found that shares a certain value, and then if you find another person who shares a different value, how do you, and then that causes conflict between the two?
Oh.
How do you talk to them in a way where you can facilitate a conversation where you can learn each other's values?
Well, you have to look past the conflict. So if you disagree, rather than see the moment as a conflict, you look at the moment and say, how can we connect? You know, the famous situation in Zen practice is the teacher says to the student, have a cup of tea. You know, and all differences are dissolved in that gesture. Together, let's share this. And all differences are dissolved. So that's what we look for. Without trying to change the other person, we try to find a way to make a connection so we can share something. Something. It doesn't have to be everything. Just something. My wife and I have some friends. You know, it's one person. My wife will say, oh, you know, she did this and this. And we both say, wow, why did she do that? But we're friends, and we do things together. Even though we may silently question, but without confronting anybody about it or anything, we just stay friends. And little by little, we come to understand each other. So, thank you. Time for one more, I think. Okay. Can it be short one?
Yeah. So the decision, I promise. Not a long story. So the decision when we make in the moment, I felt there's another aspect to it is we are in the decision when we're making this is right or wrong. We are thinking about what will my mother say, what will my father say. We are worried about, oh, this decision is going to hurt somebody. If I make this decision, this is going to be in favor of this one, and it's going to be kind of hurting someone else. So there are so many factors sometimes you have to think when making that decision. When you know that the right decision, what you want to do is this, but you just can't do it. And that has happened many times. How do you make the right decision at that time?
What is it that holds you back from making a decision that you feel good about?
Consequences.
You worry about consequences? You mean consequences to yourself?
In general.
Thank you. When you feel strongly enough about doing what you feel is the right thing to do, then you don't worry about consequences. You know, there's the legend of the Buddha. Legend, because we don't know. You know, nobody wrote it down. So, but it's a legend that says at some point he left all of the teachers and went out all on his own to meditate and to find peace and to find wisdom. And he almost starved to death because he ate hardly anything. And he was saved from starving by a young woman who came by and gave him goat's milk. But he didn't think about the consequences of the ascetic life he was about to start. He says, I have to find the truth. And didn't think about consequences. He didn't think, maybe I will die. He said, I'm giving my life to finding the truth. And didn't worry about consequences. It's a pretty high ideal for all of us to reach, but it's an ideal. And if we have a little bit of that in us, I'm going to do what's of benefit to other people, I'm going to be helpful, I'm going to relieve suffering, and there may be some consequences to me, but I'm not going to worry about that. And this is what's known as the bodhisattva mind. So this is our practice. And we're all trying to learn to live that way. Thank you.